Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to IEP Essentials Podcast, the pod that offers all things special ed. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. In this episode of IEP Essentials, we are over the moon to have Gabrielle Nicolette. Today, we are taking an in-depth conversation about all things related to speech language pathology. Gabrielle is a speech therapist and a parent coach. She is the owner and head toddler whisperer at Speech Kids, a private online speech therapy practice serving families both in and outside the DC metro area. She is also the co-founder of Raising Orchid Kids, a parent education and coaching practice. Gabrielle is passionate about showing families how to help their orchid kids, kids who need a little bit extra to thrive and not just survive. She works with children and their families one-to-one and in groups through her Raising Orchid Kids program. Welcome, welcome, and thank you for joining us. I'm so excited to get some information and hear what you have to say about this world of speech language.
I love it. Thank you for having me, Wendy. So fun.
So fun. So I guess I just really want to start with, can you help folks understand what is the difference between a speech language pathologist and a speech therapist?
Yes, because it's such a good question. There is no difference.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, but it gets confusing. Like, what is the pathology for? I don't actually know. Speech and language, and we can get into that in a second, is a more complete description. So people in the field sort of buck sometimes at this notion of speech therapist, or sometimes people say speech teacher, and then the SLPs get really freaked out because it's like, I went to grad school for blah, blah, blah. Anyway, but the short answer is a speech therapist is a speech language pathologist, is a person who helps people either learn to speak or recover their capacity to speak and understand.
So what falls within that scope of those needs that a speech language pathologist can address?
Okay, so this is a big scope of practice, and most of us specialize in some way or another. But in the scope of practice is anybody who has difficulty understanding spoken language, anybody who has difficulty speaking their native language. So we're not talking about second language learners, but we're, you know, anybody who has trouble using language generally. Also within the scope of practice for speech, speech and language pathologists or speech therapists is how we use language to communicate with other people. So that's like, it's often called pragmatics or social language is like, do we remember to say hi when we greet someone? Are we facing the person that we're talking to? Are we smiling when it's appropriate and not sort of doing unexpected or inappropriate things in the course of conversation? Are we taking turns that are matched? So, you know, an interview is kind of an artificial construct because you ask the questions and I answer the questions. But in a conversation, we're much more likely to have a balance of who's talking. And if one person is always talking, that is a pragmatic error. And so that's something that speech therapists help with. The other thing is speech clarity. So how clearly can I pronounce the sounds? And that's the one that most people are familiar with, right? So they're familiar with my child can't say his ahs or his ows. Or my child is stuttering. I think the two, speech and stuttering, are where most people stop. But it really is much more broad and deep than that.
Let me ask you. So as a parent, I'm thinking, my kids are older, but I'm just thinking if I was in a situation and I was concerned about all things speech related, what advice would you give a parent to find a speech language pathologist, because you did note that, you know, we all kind of specialize, and even in the field of special education, we kind of hone in on our craft and specialize in certain areas. So as a parent, not knowing where to turn, what would be kind of your advice to them if they're trying to figure out, does my kid need speech? You know, maybe they do. Yes, they do. And then to find the professional that would best suit their child's needs.
That's such a good question, Wendy. I think the first stop I often tell parents is their pediatrician. Often, as you know, right. That's not super fruitful unless the parent is like, no, I know something's wrong. Give me the name. And so, you know, I always tell parents, go with your gut. So if you have that thing that keeps you awake at night, then you demand of your pediatrician that they refer you to somebody. So that's the first way. The state and county programs are also a good way to get your toes wet. I do refer lots of people to Child Find and early intervention in their regional jurisdictions. And that's a free service that's provided nationwide through the IDEA, right? Individuals with Disabilities that's Education
right.
Act.
That's right. Yep.
And so that's another way to do it. More than half of the families who come to us find us on Google. Now, maybe they are asking in their mommy and daddy listserv Facebook groups. I know that that's a big source of where information gets passed around, but it's difficult. And you might have to, here's the other thing. You might have to call a few people and get their feel, because there's a lot of therapists out there. And that's a good thing, because there's a lot of different people out there, and you're not going to vibe with everybody. And that's fine.
Right? It is. And that's what I tell people through Learning Essentials, our educational therapy side, in terms of when families come to us, the same thing is, let's have a conversation, but, you know, find the best fit for your family. And that may take a couple phone calls.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Do speech and language pathologists, do they typically work alongside other special education interventionists or therapists? And what does that look like, if so?
I love that. Yes, we do.
Critical.
It's so important. I mean, here's the thing.
So right? Important.
It's all related. And we especially at Speech Kids, we focus on really, really young children, where everything is really, and you can't see, but I'm gnarling up my fingers here, because everything is intertwined, right? Your digestive system is intertwined with your speech and language communication at that age, right? So if you have a stomach ache, you're not talking.
That's right.
So we're constantly partnering with psychologists, with occupational therapists. I love partnering with OTs, because if we think about it, and most times we don't, but speech in particular, not language. Language is sort of what happens in our brains. And then speech is what happens in our mouths. It's kind of an oversimplified way to think of it. But speech is a movement-based activity, right? It's kind of like the ultimate fine motor activity. And so if a child is having difficulty with movement, then we're pretty sure there's going to be something going on the speech and language side. So we want OT. PT also. I have sent many children to physical therapy. The other ones I love to work with are like cranial sacral therapists, chiropractors, if it's the right one, acupuncture sometimes. I get a little creative in terms of body work for my clients, because I do find that some kids that I see in my practice, you know, and I think you see the same ones, they have these little developmental glitches. It's not like you were born and you coded in the hospital, although certainly we have had that too. Most of these kids are developing typically until a certain age, and then stuff starts to look a little wonky.
Yeah.
And so when that's happening, I want support. I want a lot of support from a lot of different people sometimes.
I like that you take a creative out of the box approach. Give me an example, or can you give me an example of what that would look like? You mentioned acupuncture, and you mentioned a couple other options. How would that relate, just to inform us as listeners, what that could look like and how that really kind of melds together with what you're doing?
I'll give you the most common example, just because it's something I see a lot of. We see a lot of late talkers at Speech Kids. So these are kids who are anywhere between like 16 months to 23, 24 months. Sometimes they come in older and they're still not talking. when I see a kiddo that age, I always want to observe them moving through space because that's going to tell me so much about their motor system, which is going to tell me about their talking, or their ability to talk. And I want to be asking questions about sensory, and that's a whole other podcast, but I want to know, like, how is their brain processing and interpreting things that they find in the environment, like messy yogurt on their fingers or on their face, or food in their mouths, or the swings. So there's all these kinds of little indicators that I'm asking about in a consult. And so often what happens with late talkers is they have some movement difficulty. So then if I see that, and if I even have a question about it, like, and without getting into the specifics, there are some things that we can spot about the way in which a child is moving, not whether they're walking, but how are they walking, right? Or how are they moving through space? Are they falling down a lot? Are they a crasher? Are they avoiding stuff? Like, do they not want to ever bump into the wall? And so those are the kids I refer to occupational therapy, because I know that an occupational therapist is going to deal with the sensory and the movement of this kiddo. Now, once we start to deal with sensory and movement, we get automatic, almost byproduct on the speech side. So I know that I'm going to get more progress on the speech side when I send kids who need it to OT. And we're going to do a little bit of OT. I have even actually told families at times, let's pause speech for a second. Let's devote your time and your resources to body, to occupational therapy, and then come back to me when we're a little bit more regulated and we'll really sort of hit the accelerator. Does that answer your question? Sort of a specific example?
Yeah, it does. And it's kind of leads me to my next question. You know, for what and when would we seek early intervention as a parent? Like, when do we know? I mean, as a professional, we know early intervention is key, but as a parent, what are your suggestions? Let's talk early intervention.
Let's talk early intervention. It's like my favorite thing to talk about. I think the earlier you ask the question and seek an answer, the better. Because worst case scenario, in air quotes, the professional that you see says, I don't see anything here. Now, I will say I have sent plenty of kids that I thought there was something going on to a therapist, and the therapist said, nope, they're fine. And so that's where I think that's where the second part of my answer comes in, which is I think parents know this stuff. I think they see. And when we're not in a pandemic and everybody's like alone in their homes, you go out in the world, you see your 16-month-old next to other 16-month-olds. You notice the differences. When you notice the differences and you wonder to yourself, I wonder if that's okay. That's the time.
That's the time.
I just think, because I've had so many, and this is just kind of where I get my, where I get my kicks is like if I have a 16-month-old in my practice, by the time they're two, sometimes they're done.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
It's amazing. Great. That's the best.
The best.
Ride that wave right as they're expected to, and they can stay on track and we can help them stay on track. I also have kids, to be clear, who come in at 16 months and they stay. So, that's fine. And we're happy to support those families. But the earlier you get into intervention, if we need to, the fewer behaviors on top of whatever's going on you're going to have, the less undoing of those behaviors you're going to have to do, and the less the child is going to have what I sort of call a can't do attitude, right? When you jump in early, that kiddo never knows that they were about to jump off the cliff. They get the support and they don't even know that they're getting it as they progress through their milestones. And so they feel 100% competent.
And the parents get support.
Well, also the parents get support.
So it's definitely a gift for both the child and the parents, because like you said, you have that kind of pit in your stomach questioning what is or is that or should it or could it. And then once you start kind of reaching out, you know, the answer may be everything's fine, come back, but it may be let's tackle this now and build that confidence to avoid, like you said, those behaviors and the I can't do it and then pushing back.
I think the confidence thing is big, like
huge.
I have had too many kiddos who come to me later. They're withdrawn, they're unhappy, they're fretful kids who are avoidant of demands. And the first thing I have to do with those kids is let them start to see glimmers of their own self and their own genius and their own strength and their own vibrance and spirit and all of those intangibles that get covered up when they feel like something's wrong with me. I can't do what's being asked of me. And this is all subconscious, by the way. It's not like any three-year-old is going to say, I'm not doing so well in school.
Right? Right. But we get the older students, right? The school-age students through Learning Essentials that confidence has been diminished. And it makes a huge difference to have a confident learner, I'm sure, in your practice and every practice, not I'm sure.
And I'm actually giving a presentation next week about this. That's what self-efficacy is, right? That's what resilience is. It's like, there are hard things in the world that I don't know how to do yet, but I can learn to do them. And the kids who come to you, especially, they've had years of failure and not feeling that way.
So how can parents identify if a speech delay is due to issues with speech production, auditory problems, or cognitive issues? How do they kind of...
We can't.
Sometimes they're all together.
Sometimes they're all wrapped up. Again, this goes back to sort of the younger your child is, the harder it is to determine what's happening. One thing that everybody who has questions about their child's speech and language should do is get a full audiological evaluation from an audiologist. And an audiologist usually works in an ear, nose, and throat or an otolaryngologist's office. So that's easy. Insurance will cover it. They have ways, even for very young kids, of determining whether that child is hearing well. Because hearing well is the building block for all speech and language, unless we know that you're not hearing well, in which case we're going to do sign language, right? That's unless you're deaf.
And let's kind of go back to that for a second, because I think that's a big important thing that you just said in terms of, you know, if you think your child has something with auditory processing or problems, what you're telling is to go beyond just a hearing evaluation.
Start with the hearing evaluation.
Right.
Yeah. Cross that T, dot that I. But you're right. Sometimes we're talking about auditory processing, which is a controversial term. Basically, what we're talking about is they can hear. Why can't they understand or follow through? Right. But there are different reasons for that. And so it's not always clear. Are kids not understanding? Are they not? Once we know that they can hear, we're asking, are they not able to make sense of the information? Or are they not able to act in a way that shows us that they can make sense of the information, right? So those are two different things, because often we're relying on an output response to demonstrate that the child understood what we said. That gets a little complicated.
Yeah.
Right? So, and the younger the child is, the less we know. The older they get, the more we can start to tease out what's actually happening. So a full speech and language evaluation for older kids especially is going to include some standardized testing that's going to give us information about how a child is interpreting what they hear. And so that's often a good next step if we still have questions, is a full speech and language evaluation. And then for school age kiddos, that we want that to sometimes include like a reading assessment. We might, for kids who are older than 7, do a neuropsychological assessment, which also has some speech and language and memory stuff in it, right? So memory, it turns out, is really important, different types of memory especially. So working memory, very important for understanding speech and language, right? Like you have to be able to remember the question the interviewer asked you.
But it's great to know these options as somebody that's listening in terms of kind of what next steps could look like, how you can kind of tease out different areas to provide the right support. How can parents identify the difference between a delay and a simple reluctance to speak?
That's such a great question. I don't really think that a simple reluctance to speech exists. I think a reluctance to speak is a symptom of a different issue. I think it's a strategy.
Right.
And so whether that strategy is I'm avoiding my anxiety, my performance anxiety, or I don't understand what's being said, so I'm avoiding answering so that I don't have to show that I don't understand what's being said. I think those are the big two. Oftentimes what I'm doing, especially with the younger set, is we do a fair amount of modifying what I call the linguistic environment at home, which really means how grownups are talking to kids. Because grownups tend to, and this is true to adult communication, we ask a lot of questions when we feel like we're not getting a lot of information, right? So if you think about how we interact with teenagers or reluctant spouses, right? Spouse comes home, doesn't say anything. You're like asking a bunch of questions. Well, it turns out when we do that to preschoolers, toddlers, preschoolers, even early elementary, even middle school, like nobody's talking. And so we double down on the questions, right? We try to make it easier for them to participate. And the whole time they're just sort of mentally, sometimes physically, just backing up away from us. So one of the first things we do when I'm coaching parents as part of direct speech therapy is I'm getting them to ask many, many, many fewer questions. Because we already know we're not going to get an answer. We knew that last week. So why are we doing this? So many fewer questions, more statements, fewer questions is like one of my go-to strategies that we use. And it's hard. Parents find that very difficult.
Well, it is hard, especially if that's kind of how you're programmed, is to ask a lot more, and then to have to reel that in. But you, Gabrielle, can you just share, you really do something super cool where you kind of put a bug in their ear and the kids don't even know that you're talking to the parent. And so it's a very natural sequence of events that take place to help guide and coach the parents.
This has been so fun and so effective. It was born of the pandemic when we all jumped online in 2 days. I realized very quickly, right, there are these kids who they don't do well on the screen. They can't sit and like directly communicate with somebody who's face to face with them and who's not able to be on the floor sort of in parallel play and then sort of crossing over. So I shut off my camera. We would do like nanny cam on the room. So I could see the room, but I was not visible. And then I had the parent wear a headset, and I am able, and I'm still doing this, I am able to coach parents and tell them exactly what to say, exactly when to say it, and exactly how to say it, which again, some of this you get in the weeds and you're like, really? But for example, little guy playing with cars, and mom, usually mom, sometimes dad, says, oh, are you playing with the cars? So that's a usual response. And then of course you get nothing. What we do during one of these bug in your ear sessions is I'll just have the parent be quiet for a second until we see what's happening. So I'm saying, okay, hang on. And then I'll say, and I have primed them to imitate me. I'll say, car. And then the parent will say, car. And I'll say, no, more, with an exclamation point, car. So we can really get down to the nitty gritty. But the magic of what happens when that happens is, number one, I'm able to like use the parent as my avatar, which means that when the child, and this is a when, not if, looks at the parent with this expression of delight that they have understood what's happening, all that juiciness and all that love and all that goodness goes between the parent and the child, which is really where it belongs.
Yes. Oh, that's so special. I love that. Oh my gosh. Warms your heart as a parent, for sure. What's the difference between a diagnosis and prognosis?
I love talking about this. So to your earlier point, our earlier point about how we sometimes don't know, is this a speech issue or a language issue? Is this a thinking issue or just kind of a little glitch that's happening? Diagnosis is like a verbal description, largely for insurance purposes, for reimbursement, like for money purposes, that we give to a child, foist upon a child, that it's an attempt to help professionals understand what we're looking at. What it doesn't have, in my experience, what it does not have is any impact on the future. It gives us very little information about prognosis, which is what we expect from the child in the future moving forward. What can we expect in terms of progress? What can we expect in terms of outcome? Now, I happen to operate, again, on the younger side of the spectrum, age spectrum, where it's really hard to know. Like we're making some major brain shifts with 18-month-olds, where by the time they get to kindergarten, nobody might know that they were ever in intervention. Some of them will still be in intervention, but some of them might not be. And again, they all start with the same diagnosis, or they might. And so that's like actually a concrete example of 18 months. Maybe we have two kids with speech and language delay. One of them, age 5, goes to kindergarten. The other one, we're still considering school placement. We're holding them back for a year. They're still in intervention. We're still dealing with some stuff. And we don't know.
No, we don't have that magic ball.
Nope.
No. But the diagnosis helps kind of give us some background and give us some information so that we can make those plans and goals for the sessions that we're working with that student and then for that collaboration component. But it certainly doesn't pigeonhole, or we don't want it to pigeonhole that child for any reason. So what can parents expect from an initial speech language evaluation?
Depending on the age of the child, we might do, at our practice, we do like an informal evaluation, which does not include any standardized testing, but does include some functional, like how is your child functioning in their day, kinds of information that then will give us kind of a roadmap to what we want to be doing in therapy. So that's for kids 3 and under, or kids who are nonverbal, if they're older. Any older than 3, we want to have some standardized measures. We want to do some language tests. We want to understand about speech clarity. We want to understand about spoken language. We want to understand about understanding receptive language. And we want to understand something about articulation and phonology, which is like, how are we hearing the building blocks for the sounds that we're going to need to read later? Like all of that, right? Rhyming, all that stuff. And then based on what we see, based on standardized scores, based on functional observation, like again, so much. And I really come down strongly on the functional side of things. Like, I want to know, are you able to do the things that you need to do in the environment in which you find yourself? And then if you're not, then we have to decide, are we going to change the environment? And if so, how? Or are we going to try to change you? And if so, how? So those are the two.
As a parent, you know, you receive this information, you kind of to walk us through this, you have this gut feeling, you reach out to a specialist, they're evaluated, and then it's time to start to receive therapy. You know, how long, and I know every kid's different, kind of what is a guideline for parents or questions that they could ask in terms of the length of therapy, and, you know, what indicates that a child has made progress, that they've made enough progress that you can start weaning back on therapy, mm-hmm. the whole thing. I think parents have a lot of questions about that.
Yeah.
It's a magic ball again, for sure. Yeah.
So without the magic eight ball, I just had this conversation this morning, which is in speech, particularly speech therapists generally, and I don't know where this comes from. It's just kind of it's the cultural water. We understand it is our job to put ourselves out of a job. Yes. That's the goal, right? Is like,
that means you're doing your job well.
That means we're doing it really well. So as soon as we can get a kid out of our caseloads, that's what we want. And we never want to let a child go just to see, you know, we don't want to push a baby bird out of the nest without knowing that they can at least sort of fly a little bit, right? And so when parents say to me, so how long is this going to take? I have to say, I don't know.
I would imagine you get that often.
All the time. I do things two ways. One is I take a macro level and then we'd have a micro level. So macro level is think in 6 month chunks. We're going to be here 6 months to a year at least. And again, it's my job to put myself out of a job. So if we're doing weekly sessions and all of a sudden we notice Junior is doing just fine, we're going to fade. And then we're going to fade again. And then I'm going to check in with you in 3 months and see what's happening. Like, you know, we're not contracted to work together for 6 months. So that's kind of macro. At a micro level, we're always tracking goals and progress against those goals. And then I like to be meeting with parents every 6 to 8, 10 weeks so that we can be measuring, like, how do we think this is going? Are we making progress? What have we noticed? What are you seeing at home? What are we seeing in therapy? Right? Because there is this lag between skills that we see, usually skills that we see in therapy and then skills we see at home. And actually, as I'm saying that, a lot of times with my youngers, we see the skill demonstrated at home before we see it in therapy, which is kind of crazy. Yeah, we're constantly monitoring and we're constantly reassessing. I mean, I think, you know, diagnostic therapy or therapeutic diagnosis, like whichever one you want to do, but we constantly have to be probing, right? Where are we now? Where are we now? Where are we now? Did it work? Do we know?
Right. Why do you think it is that a parent would see that skill demonstrated in their home versus in a therapeutic setting?
I have this theory. I wish it's the world according to Gabrielle. Who knows? We have, in my experience, kids have an automatic channel and an on-demand channel in terms of their speech and language output. So on what I mean by on-demand channel is I, the adult, am telling you, the child, what we're talking about, how I want you to respond, what an appropriate response type is, and you're constrained. That is often much more difficult for the kids that I see than the automatic channel where kid's in his bed, he's talking to himself, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden you hear sushi, which actually happened this week from this nonverbal 2-year-old, right? So,
delicious.
Delicious, right? And so that happens all the time where we're working on target words in therapy that I might never hear a child say, but then I hear from the parent that, oh yeah, he was playing with his blah blahs the other day and all of a sudden he was saying that word. So that's how that works in my experience again.
So what are some main communication challenges that you see kiddos facing today?
That feels like a really big question, Wendy.
It's a big question. And I think just, I mean, gosh, on one level, you have the pandemic, kids are wearing masks, mm-hmm. they've been on a screen. Then we have social media, we have texting.
I know the social language piece. Social language is a big one, social emotional language. And so I think what I mean by that is, number one, how we interact with other people, but also how kids are able to feel comfortable expressing their emotions. And what kind of signals they're getting about what is and isn't acceptable about expressing their emotions, whether kids feel able to express their preferences, whether they feel understood by an adult in terms of the experiences that they're having. And so to your point about the pandemic, you know, it's important for parents to be having a conversation with their kids, even if their child is not understanding the words being said, but that they're understanding the energy behind the words of, yeah, this is really hard. We're seeing people and we all have to wear masks and this is just weird. You know, that signaling from the adults at a level that the kids can understand?
That was a big question. Yeah. You know, I mean, and it's different and it depends on the kid's age. It depends on their environment. It depends, you know, are they school aged? Are they not? So that was a lot in one question.
You know
question.
What the other thing is, Wendy, though, the part of your question that hit me is for kids, especially who are these ORCID kids, right? They have something happening. They're sensitive. They have brain-based learning differences. They struggle in the world. For those kids, oh, I'm going to get emotional even thinking about it. It's so crucial for those kids to have somebody in their corner who can see them for the whole wonderful, special, unique soul that is underneath all of the brain-based whatever that doesn't actually, I mean, you know, that doesn't matter that much from a distance, right? If we're not seeing our kids, and I'm talking about parents, I'm talking about clinicians, I'm talking about anybody who interfaces with a child, right? If we're just seeing what we want to see as a projection of ourselves without taking into account that even though they are small, they are their own being. That's where I think that's why your question felt heavy, because it's so crucial that ORCIDs in particular have someone who knows them, like knows them with a capital K.
And they feel seen and they feel heard.
Seen and heard.
And they feel safe.
Yes. Yes.
They feel safe. And, you know, and that there is so empowering for the child to know that everything that's going on within them, that somebody sees them for who they are, trusts them, loves them. There's a lot of emotion and passion behind what you do, because it's such great work and it's needed for especially those ORCID kids that really just need somebody in their corner to help, you know, and they understand whether they can articulate it or not when somebody understands them.
Well, and this is
when it's genuine.
Yeah.
Right. Whether it's a clinician, a teacher, a therapist, a pediatrician, whomever it is on their team, they know inside that this person gets me.
That's right. That's exactly
which is incredibly empowering.
Yeah. Yeah.
For everyone.
And that's what I love being able to do over the with the bug in your ear, actually, is because we can align the parents' behavior and their internal mechanism. And then we get that connection between parent and child. And that's what I really love, is I can kind of calibrate the dials there, right?
How beautiful is that? How beautiful so is that? Good. Yes. Oh, well, to kind of change gears a little bit. Mm-hmm. That was,
I know. I'm like, oh, I'm all verklempt.
Grab the tissue. Yeah. Kind of back to this. I guess this is going to sound really clinical question after our just now conversation, but what is the difference between speech delays, language delays, fluency disorders, cognitive communication disorders? I know we could do a whole class, a dissertation on just one of those items, but just kind of, can we give parents a little snippet of what that means kind of together or separately?
Sure. I think the short answer is all of those things are behavioral manifestations of something that's going on in the brain that we don't really know what it is, because we don't put kids in brain scanners yet. So we're often, the frustrating part about doing this work is that we're often, if not always, dealing with behavioral manifestations of a neurological process, right? So that makes it hard. We have to be really good detectives, which is why we got to look at motor. We got to look at play. We got to look at behavior. We have to look at all these things, because they're all telling us, okay, what are the neurological mechanisms that are affected, right? So to your question about like, how are all these things different? They're all related to communication, and they're just sort of different slices of the communication pie. So a person who stutters may or may not, usually doesn't, have other speech and language issues happening. They have a primary problem with pronouncing and moving through So it's a motor-based disorder. So it happens in your mouth, not in your brain, even though everything's happening in your brain because your brain is controlling your mouth. Okay, fine. But it is a motor-based problem where sounds are repeated and the speech mechanism has trouble getting through those syllables. An articulation issue is more in that camp, right? Because it's a problem making the movements that one needs in order to have clear speech. If we're talking about language stuff, that's happening in the brain before speech happens. So, right, a language problem is I see a glass on the table and I think, I don't know what that is. I know what it's for. I know what it does. I know you put water in it, but I can't say the word cup or glass, or I don't think that word, versus a speech problem where I would look at a glass on the table and say tup with a T, right? That's a speech problem.
So what's the most common then out of these?
Probably speech, probably sort of motor output issues is my guess. And here's why I think that. In the Western world, we place a really high price on being very verbal. And so I think kids, if they are able and willing, they will comply with expectations that they be very verbal at the cost of the motor output. So we have kids who want to say very complex things, who are in an environment where very complex things are being praised. And then we've got kids whose motor systems, so their mouths, are not moving as well or as quickly. And it's not because of any developmental glitch, although it might be. They're just pushing, they're taxing their motor systems. And then they develop some sort of quote unquote bad habits that we have to unwind, which are pretty easy to unwind if nothing else is going on. But I do think, you know, there's an increase for sure in motor planning, like a childhood apraxia of speech is said to be very, very rare, which it probably is in the general population, but I see a lot of kids who seem to have it. Again, this is a whole diagnosis versus prognosis question, right? There's certainly autism is on the rise, and autism automatically comes with some speech and language issues, mostly language.
So what would you say is the most difficult to treat?
It depends on sort of where you're coming from. I like to look at things from a holistic perspective. So again, like, can you do the things you need to be doing in the environment in which you find yourself and in the environment that we think you're going to be in going forward? And so from that perspective, somebody who comes to me who has communication skills where the pragmatics or the social piece is most impacted, that's the longer term, harder, sort of squirrelier aspects of language, because it's not super concrete, right? Like anybody who has social pragmatic issues, you know it when you see it because the skills aren't there, but it's not like we walk around identifying, oh, they're looking me in the eye every 10 seconds and that feels really good. But if they looked at me for 30 seconds straight, I would start to feel really uncomfortable. Well, it turns out that that's actually true, but it's not anything we think about until it's gone wrong.
Right.
So I think the social pragmatic piece as regards autism in particular, but also other social pragmatic language issues that, you know, certainly kids with anxiety present with social pragmatic issues. Those are hard because they're multi-layered.
They're multi-layered and needing kind of a pronged approach, or multi-layered and just a singular approach?
They need a multi-pronged approach. They need help to deal with the mechanics of what it is they're trying to do from a communication standpoint. They need help in terms of being aware that they either want or don't want to make changes. Often, as we get into later years, if you've got social pragmatic difficulties early on, that's going to lead to mental behavioral health concerns. And so lots of kids with autism diagnoses also present with depression sometimes. Also present with anxiety. You need a team. We need a team.
But that's the good side of it, is to pull in folks that understand, back to what we were just saying, understanding your kiddo and seeing your kiddo Kind of, Gabrielle, as we're winding down our amazing conversation today, is there something that I did not ask, that I didn't know enough to ask, that I should have asked?
Oof. You know a lot, Wendy. I think here's the thing. It's about communication is about way more than the words we say. It starts Amen. At birth, right? Communication starts at birth when you are looking at your baby and your baby is looking at you. And then fast forward 6 weeks and they start smiling, right? That reciprocal smile, that's turn-taking, that's communication. And so if we think about communication as a pyramid, speech goes at the top. It doesn't go at the bottom. If we think about that pyramid, it actually, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many words our child says. It matters sort of quality of interactions, you know, and sort of all of those prerequisite skills that are going into place at the base of the pyramid. We want to make sure those are in place, and then we can start messing around with speech.
So I always ask my guest this kind of final question. If you had a billboard and you could put a word or a phrase on that billboard for parents to see, what would that be and why?
Trust your gut. Does that count? That's three words.
Yeah, that totally counts. That absolutely 100% trust your gut.
Trust your gut. Do not allow neighbors, family members, doctors, well-meaning people behind you in the grocery store, drive your bus.
Yes, very true. It is very true. And keep asking questions.
Absolutely.
Until you figure it out, until your gut starts to settle and you feel like, all right, we're on to something. I'm getting the support my kiddo needs. Trust your gut. Yeah. Amazing. Well, Gabrielle, this was an honor to have a conversation with you. I hope as people listen, they're going to have more conversations. They can reach out to you. I'll put your information in the show notes so folks know how to find you and get your excellent support. Come on over to Learning Essentials and follow us to find more tips and information. And so thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a delight. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.